You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with street photographer and, as I see, artist Sid Limits, who I initially got to know through Facebook. Sid, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you for your interest in me, Brainerd.
You're welcome. I mean, my interest in you really is started, and I think the way that would be ideal for most artists is I was simply drawn to your images. It was on Facebook, and I noticed your images coming up, and we know everybody posts photographs on Facebook. That's the currency of Facebook, but when photographers post them, and good photographers, it stands out dramatically. Mm-hmm. And your work did.
Well, it's certainly an exciting time to be alive because I've been doing this since 1974. And for years I shot Kodachrome slides. And I was never big on printing or exhibiting because I was always interested in shooting more. So for years I shot Kodachrome and occasionally shoot black and white negatives. And I went to art school, Mass College of Art, and studied.
Wait, before you get there, let me ask you something.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm fascinated by that, but I'd like to know a little bit about where you grew up, your beginnings. How did you where did you grow up and where did you come from?
I grew up in a place overlooking the Baker chocolate factory, and I think that's why I'm a visual artist, because I had this amazing, from age 0 to 10, I overlooked the factory, and they moved out of this place called Milton, Mass., Milton Village, Mass., and they moved out in about 1965 to Dover, Delaware, and it's just, right now, it's still, the mills are still there, but now they're, you know, pricey condos, and it's just a wonderful visual place to look at, and ironically, the house that I grew up in is now a photography studio.
Huh, and that's in Milton, Mass. And your parents, what did they do?
Well, they met in this country. They immigrated from Ireland. I'm first generation Irish American, and I know the different traits from each parent. My mother was very funny, and my father could really size situations and people up. So I have a bit of the sensitive and the very funny side to me, because we'll probably get into later that I was a comedian at one point in my career as well.
Huh, so tell me a little bit about your name then. Limits doesn't sound like an Irish name.
Oh, well, Sid Limits, there's nobody really named Sid Limits. I changed my name the first time when I was an apprentice at a summer music theater. And I decided, I'm going to be meeting all new people. It'll be fun to have a different name. So I changed my name to Finney Michaels, because my real name is Michael Finland.
And you changed it legally, or
for everyone to call me Finney, my name backwards. And I just thought it'd be fun just to change my name. So in the 70s, I was part of a group called Punk Dada. I wasn't an official member, but I used to exhibit with them. And there was a show at the Architectural Center on Newbury Street, and it was a big happening, about 800 people, and I was doing my comedy slide routine. And Kitty Litter, who's since passed on, she was a scenester, she was a fashion designer. There was loud music, and she said, "What's your name?" I said, "My name is Finney." And she says, "City?" I said, City, City Point, City Hall, Sid E. Limits. So I changed it in the 70s. I was C-I-D-D-Y, L-I-M-I-T-Z, and I did the disco scene, taking pictures of the clubs under the name City Limits. And then I would be out another night as Mickey Finney during the punk scene. So I was a couple of different personalities going on there and at once.
Huh. That's great. Okay, so let me trace back a little bit then, because that's fascinating. I'd love to know how you got to that point. So you were born in Mass, and then when did you first start shooting photography? When did you start taking photographs? At what age?
I first started shooting movies. My father gave me his 8mm movie camera, and a lot of my work is I shoot like it's a movie, and kind of like my life is a movie, and I'm Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, and I'm still waiting to click my heels and find out where is this all going. But so I started shooting film, and then I remember the first time I said, "Gee, I should have a camera," and it was outside of a concert at the Music Hall, Bette Midler concert.
And how old were you then?
I was 16 or 17, and I said, "Gee," she happened to come out the front door, and she met with some people, and I said, "This would be fun to have a camera and document this." So then I think I got a camera for Christmas in 1973. So I started shooting 35 in 74. You know.
Okay, and you were going into college, so that was the beginning of your career in photography, and you stopped shooting the Super 8 films or the 8mm films?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a career in photography. I remember the first day of art school orientation in the Longwood Theater, which is now gone, but they at the assembly they said, "Now, students, just realize this, that you'll take two paths with your art. You'll either get a 9-to-5 job or become a waiter and waitress, and whatever money you have left over you'll put towards your own personal art, or you'll get a job making art, and that's what you'll be paid for." So I took the work 9-to-5 or work somewhere and just have money to do it on my own.
And that was after high school or
yeah,
college?
I took a year off after high school and just worked a few places, and then 1975 I started freshman year at Mass College of Art.
And then after graduating, what happened?
After graduating, I ended up working a few jobs. I took a long route to go to college. I took a few semesters off. I should have had a nervous breakdown, but I didn't have it. So that 1977, that kind of delayed me. And 1980, I went as an exchange student to Philadelphia. I was kind of extending my youth by still going to college because I had taken several semesters off, and I went to Philadelphia College of Art as an exchange student, and that was fun, being in a different city. And you know, that was the year that the baseball team won their first World Series. So and I used to take the bus to Allentown and I think Hamburg because I was shooting professional wrestling, and I would take the bus to the wrestling matches where they used to shoot them on TV, and they were also filming Blowout with John Travolta. And I remember walking up to Brian De Palma with my camera, and I took his picture, and one production assistant said, "You know, that took a lot of balls, what you just did." I guess it
who
does,
said that to you? Who said that to you?
A production assistant.
Right.
And the same thing happened. Marty Scorsese was filming a movie in Chinatown in Boston, The Departed, and he was walking on the street, and I shot a bunch of pictures of him, and it was like he was walking with his apostles. And one of his production assistants said the same thing to me, like, "I wouldn't have done that if I was you." But anyway, I'm not intimidated by people. I treat all people as, you know, people, and famous or non-famous, it's all relative.
And so that was what age? So that's kind of that was a big precursor to what you would be doing for a lot of the rest of your life, which is having that kind of nerve and doing that kind of street photography.
Right, right. And another interesting job I had, when you asked what I did after college, I ended up working backstage at a theater. I was a union usher for years. I worked at every single movie theater in Boston because I love show business. I worked at movie theaters, and I worked at legitimate theaters, and then an opening at the stage door opened up in 83. So I worked at Jordan Marsh on the phone during the day, and I would go to the theater at night. And all kinds of actors and actresses, famous people, would come in, and it would be me sitting by the door, and them, each side, there was a dressing room. But little did they know that there was somewhat of a paparazzo sitting there. I'm not really a paparazzo, but I would sit there, and then I would warm up to them, and a week or two later, I'd pop my head in the dressing room door. I said, "May I take a picture of you?" And sure enough, they would They would say, yes, I actually did a photo shoot with Charlton Heston. I brought photo lamps in, and it was just me and Charlton in his dressing room, and he said to me, you know, you can imagine I've done a lot of these in my day. And he was a very nice man, even though I don't agree with his politics, but he was there with Alexis Smith. And I have a beautiful picture of Alexis Smith. Your listeners wouldn't really know who she was, but I just have a beautiful picture of her the last day leaving the backstage, and she was about to work with Martin Scorsese, and I told her that many times when people have small roles in his films, they become larger, and I think she had a glow with that picture after I told her that.
What year was that you were working at the theater, and that was the beginning of of meeting those kind of people? When was that?
Well, I've always met those kind of people because I was drawn to show business. 1975, I was chosen to be an apprentice, and it was a big deal because it was maybe 14 out of 500 applicants chosen. I didn't really have any talent per se.
To be an apprentice for who? Where was that?
This was at a summer theater called the South Shore Music Circus, an old tent, and they'd have legitimate shows, and now it's pretty much Vegas and, Willie Nelson and people like that, one-nighters. But back then it was book shows where we'd actually run the sets down the aisles and do different jobs with the different productions. So, we had cast parties, and I went to a cast party with Zero Marstel was there. I have a pretty good shot of Zero Marstel, and we were in the dressing room one night with Zero, and he was giving us advice on acting. And so I've met, for some reason, my paths have crossed with a lot of famous people,
But you weren't shooting 8mm film anymore. That was all stills you were shooting of these people.
Right. In 1975, I shot, when I applied to be an apprentice, I put on the application, if I do get this gig or job, I will have to fly to New York to attend the opening of Chicago, opening night. And I think that's what got me in, because they thought, sounds interesting. So I actually left Cohasset. I was, 19 years old, and I flew to New York to photograph the opening night of Chicago. One of my heroes, artists, is Bob Fosse. Not so much his stage shows, but his films. I used to go down to New York every time his film opened. I'd just go down to the opening just to see it. And he never disappointed with his films, but with some of his productions like Dancing and, M.E.H., how do you pronounce that? Meh? Meh?
Right.
But he was my favorite filmmaker, and I got to tell him that when he was in Boston for doing a show, his last show, The Big Deal at the Schubert. That's when we used to get a lot of pre-Broadway shows. And I photographed him. I said, you're my favorite film director, and he thanked me.
Wow. So how did that begin to change or shape your style? So now you're getting older at that point. You're meeting all these celebrities. You're gaining access to them, and your photography is getting better. What did that change? How you were looking at them or the medium of photography? At all
well,
for you?
When you work with famous people, you get all awestruck, but then all of a sudden you're with them for half a day and you just become regular working people. I worked with Geraldine Page. I was, Lee Remick, Eric Bogosian. I had another photo shoot with him. I brought in lights, and he called me the ultimate voyeur because I'd be sitting on the door just watching things. And and then I moved to the Wang Center and the Colonial. Just 2 years ago, I stopped doing this because my job was outsourced by a security outfit. There's no longer the Goodnight Pops, the old-time doorman you see in the movies. It's now a security outfit. And they don't read Variety, and they don't know the latest grosses.
So that was your job for how long?
About 20 years. That was my side job because you couldn't depend on it because the theaters would be dark for 2 months, and then would be active for 3 months, and then another week. And so it was fun because it was like a new movie came to town every show. And I, between you and me and the audience, I used to sneak up on the stage after I'd be the only one in the theater and in the Colonial, and I'd sneak around the set taking pictures. Of course, I can't do anything with these pictures because they're all copyrighted works of other, you know, designers. And I would I didn't do the Carol Burnett thing. Maybe I did a couple of lines to the you know, empty house, but I had fun, you know.
Uh-huh.
And
you were doing your comedy. Was your comedy in around that time? Because we haven't even talked about that. But this is how I know you now, as someone who's a street photographer, but often seems to have, yes, celebrities or well known people. And now I understand the connection to theater. But you were also doing something completely different with your comedy and slideshows, weren't you?
Yes. Well, I went out to Hollywood in 1976. It was my second trip. I first went to Hollywood with on a senior class trip, and it was me and 14 girls from high school, senior year. And the first day on the trip, I said to two girls from my class, "Let's go to Hollywood." And we crossed the highway, and you know, when you're 17, you can get away with spontaneous things like this. And
right. We
put our thumbs out, and a state patrolman picked us up and said, "You know what, you shouldn't really be here, but I'll take you to where you can thumb." So he picked us up and took us a couple of miles down the road, and we started thumbing. And this man in a pickup truck picked us up and took us for a tour of Hollywood for about an hour. And he took us back to meet his wife, and he took us back to the hotel. It was the Howard Johnson's in Anaheim, because it was one of those packaged Disneyland trips. So then a couple
right.
nights later, I get another couple of girls from the class, so let's go to Hollywood. It's 4 in the morning, and I splurged for a taxi to Hollywood. I don't know what I was thinking, but we ended up in Hollywood about 4 in the morning. But we all got back and all in one piece.
Huh, amazing. And tell me a little bit about the comedy. How did that begin?
Well, I was always funny. I was class clown in the eighth grade. I was hysterical, and I actually wrote a play based on Columbus, and Sister Anne Virginia liked my work, and on graduation she said, "Oh, send me tickets to your Broadway opening night." I'll always remember that. But and then in high school, I kind of got a little shell-shocked, and I wasn't funny in high school, after high school, I kind of blossomed again when I went to art school. But I was always funny, and I was funny in at college. And then I went out to Hollywood the second time in 1976, and that, as you know, was the bicentennial. And I always wanted to go cross country on a bus, so I looked in the Phoenix at the time, and saw a bus, one of those hippie buses, was going across country. So that same year, I bought a pair of red, white, and blue sneakers. And I brought them on. I wore them on the bus, and the bus was made up of pretty much not very friendly older hippie types, and they weren't much fun. And actually, the bus broke down in Kansas. I was never more happy to get off that bus, and I ended up taking a Greyhound bus the rest of the way. But they'd stop the bus every 20 minutes and play frisbee, and a very nice bus driver would ask, where do you guys want to go on this trip? And I'd say, "Oh, I'd like to go through Las Vegas." And they go, "Ooh, who wants to go through Las Vegas? Ew." So they're just, we just didn't really connect with that group. So I took the bus from Kansas somewhere to Hollywood, and a friend of mine invited me out to stay with him. He was an apprentice from the summer before, and he went out to Hollywood to be an actor. And he was very handsome with a deep voice, and, you know, everyone thought he was going to be, you know, one of the actors. Well,
right.
It turns out he was also thumbing on Santa Monica Boulevard. This is, of course, pre-AIDS, but turns out he was also a male prostitute. And there was, you know, back then, you'd go on Santa Monica Boulevard, you'd see all these handsome young boys with their thumbs out, and that's how they made a living. So basically, Chris kicked me out of his apartment when I got there, and I was pretty much homeless in Beverly Hills, like the movie. But I walked through Beverly Hills through where there was no sidewalks, and I ended up down at UCLA, and the fraternities were renting rooms for $50 a month. So I got a room there for $50. And the reason, another reason I went out to Hollywood, I wanted to be a tour guide at Universal. I thought that would be fun. But I didn't have a phone, and turns out the woman that was in charge of that tried to get a hold of me but couldn't. So while I was in UCLA, there was a comedy club called The Comedy Store. You've heard of it. There was one that's more famous in Hollywood, but there was another club in Westwood. There was an open mic night. And I asked them, I brought some slides with me from my comedy, where I did a comedy thing about being a beat.
And that was your first time ever doing something like that?
Comedy?
Well, yeah. Like that. I mean, that's very bold, standing up in front of people
and having
a kind of routine, or even improvising on a routine.
Right, right. And basically, I borrowed a projector, and I had the slides, and I nailed it. And people were literally wetting their pants laughing, and made some friends that took me out. We went out up into the mountains because they thought I was so cool. I was funny. And Mitzi Shore, that's Sig Shore's wife, I believe, and Pauly Shore's mother, wasn't there that night. So they said, you got to come back. You got to come back. You got to see Mitzi. Mitzi's got to see you. So I went back to the same fellow at UCLA. I said, can I borrow the projector again? Because I have another tryout this Tuesday. He says, no, you know, you already had it once. So I was in Hollywood a couple of days later, and there's a woman having a yard sale. Her name was Yvette, and I do have a beautiful portrait of her, if I may say so, black and white. But she was moving out of her house, and she had all kinds of things she was selling, and she was very appreciative that I was helping her. And one cameo, Darren McGavin walked up and said hello. But turns out Yvette was one of the original R Gang, the Little Rascals.
Oh, wow.
And she said, you know what, you've been so nice to me. I want you to have anything you want. You can have anything you want here. So I said, you know what, this is fantastic. I'm doing a comedy show this week, and I'd love to have that projector. So she gave me the projector, but it wasn't a carousel projector. It was something from the 50s, like you see in the old high school with the strips.
Right, you run the 35-millimeter strips through them.
So cue the uh-oh from I Love Lucy.
Right.
So I line up, and Mitzi's there, and I get on stage, and I didn't have a dry run with my projector. The bulb worked, and I plugged it in, and it was a disaster because the slides were out of focus. And I had also a book of a suitcase with props. So while I was bombing on stage, I said, oh, I love show business. And then a woman in the front row said, well, why are you trying to kill it? So I went up to Mitzi. I said, Mitzi, it's not the way it was supposed to be. She goes, you know what? You're cute up there, but less props. And then I did one more time. I went down to the Improv on July 4th, 1976. And I went to Bud Friedman's Improv. And the guy really liked me. He says, you know what? I see a lot of germs in you. Come back, come back. And basically, I was also sneaking on MGM, the set of New York, New York. And you don't know how you do these things when you're young, you can do all these seems like spontaneous things without planning it. But you know.
So by sneaking on the sets of MGM, what would that do for you?
Well, I walked on the set as if I belonged there the first day, and I walked on the set, and there was Liza Minnelli with. A big musical number being filmed. Most of it was cut out of the movie called Aces High. And Vincent Minnelli walked on the set. And actually, in my trip, 1974, I actually knocked on Vincent Minnelli. I met Vincent Minnelli and walked around the block with his dog. He lived across the street from the Beverly Hills Hotel. And...
Wow, okay, but you walked on the set that day, that first time to MGM, and you just walked on as though you were a part of the crew, snapping pictures. How is it that then you befriended Liza Minnelli or other people there, because you're an unknown to them, right?
Well, no, I kind of know Liza from a few years previous, and I have a Liza Minnelli tribute site called Hazoy.com, and you can see a picture I took of her in 1975 when I went to see her when she was filling in Chicago. So I saw her the first time when she was awarded the Hasty Pudding Woman of the Year. And when I was in high school, like I mentioned, I was pretty alone, and I went to the high school library one day, and I saw this Paris Match magazine, and it was a layout of Liza from Cabaret. I'd never heard, the film hadn't been released yet, and it was like, you had me at a hello type moment where there was just this one picture where I just stared at it, and it was like, wow, I like this person. She's one of the people I like to follow and photograph and so on.
So because you walked onto the MGM set that day, she had seen you before, and that in part gave you some entree there, or I mean it was just.
Well, I don't want to get too much involved in the Liza thing here, but she waved as if like, there's Michael, and I actually went to see the Rushes with her that night, and I pushed aside the hairdresser to sit next to her, and the Rushes looked amazing, but it was strange that it was never used in the film. New York, New York has become a kind of a cult musical, and there was about a 20-minute sequence that was cut out called Happy Endings. It was original Kendra Nebb sequence, and only about 5 minutes of it ended up in the movie. But if you get the Blu-ray DVD, the full 20 minutes is, and I saw some of that footage.
Wow, that's a great tip. Yeah. Okay, so then moving on with... As you developed, then you came back to the East Coast at some point. You continued to do the comedy that was in, and that just kind of introduced you, I imagine, to a different circle of people. Or how did the comedy begin developing yourself as a photographer?
Right, I went back to finish school, and I would do comedy bits at the punk clubs and the lofts, and I tried out the comedy connection right before it took off, and I was pretty funny, and I didn't really have anybody in my corner saying yes, you can do it, and you really need that in life to pursue your dreams, and I never really had that in terms of my comedy, but I'm a funny fuck. Can you say fuck on this radio?
Sure.
Okay. So maybe someday I'll be like a late bloomer like Rodney Dangerfield and start it up again. I certainly have the face for radio and comedy. So back to photography. I always photographed, and that 76 trip, a lot of it was walking up to strangers and asking them if they would like to be part of a photo essay I'm doing on the bicentennial, and they'd say sure, and I'd pull off my red, white, and blue sneaker and have them hold it. So I did this all throughout the country, and then I came back to Boston and did it. I wrote a note to Frank Zappa, and I went backstage, and he held it. And Miss America held it, and Dick Clark and Gilda Radner and Everyday Americans. And then I did a comedy skit. I switched from photography to a program at MassArt called SIM, Studio for Interrelated Media. It was kind of the early days of performance art. And the photography department really didn't get me all that much, so I switched over to SIM, which allowed more freedom. So I did this comedy routine about sneakers, and then the screen would open up with all the pictures to, I think, Steve Miller Living in the USA, and then Frank Zappa, Features in Regalia. And it was a big hit, as far as a college show would go. And I did a follow-up, Turn the Beat Around, and that was my comedy routine about being a beat, and that's what I did in Hollywood the year before, where I did all these beat puns, like it was called Offbeat Humor. Why do I do this kind of humor? It beats me. If you don't like it, go beat it. Here's a picture of a cop on the beat, and there's a beat with a nick in it. That's a beatnik. And it just went on and on, and just people with my dry voice and my look, just it was pretty funny. But it wasn't meant to be, like everything else, with that slide projector story.
And today, so moving forward to how I know and where you are today, you're living in Boston, and you're still a street photographer. You're still shooting a lot of well-known people, from trials to theater, and looking back on your career, How do you see what you're doing now? It seems very, very, very powerful and solid. Artists talk about, you know, developing a body of work or having consistency. One thing that is remarkable to me about your work now is its consistency of vision. I mean, obviously, you're editing what you're putting up on Facebook, which is an interesting aspect of Facebook. But how do you feel about? Yeah.
Well, I have a gift of just being able to go up to strangers in all different situations, and I'm very sensitive, and I'm very visual. I know what a good photograph looks like, but I haven't changed since actually Kodachrome or not printing negatives. Basically, I just shoot, and I might put something up on Facebook, and then I will just put that picture away, and I just have. Usually take about 70,000 pictures every 6 or 7 months. I went to the Apple store and they wanted me to go with a show example of someone that shot 70,000 pictures. I'm not the most technically enhanced person. And back to how things haven't changed, I would shoot Kodachrome, and because it was a cost factor, it might be months or years before I would develop them. Now I'm basically... The pictures are ready and ready for the world to see a few hours later, and then that's nice. I go on and I shoot more, and then I have about 4,000 pictures on Facebook, and I realize that when you put something on the internet, you're just pretty much giving your work away. But I have so many other photographs that I haven't even seen that, you know. So what, I'm giving away a fraction of what I have.
And how has Facebook worked for you? I mean, as an artist, that is one of the more amazing mediums to communicate in, if it works for you, and you're someone who, in my estimate, it does seem to be working for you. Do you perceive it that way, or has it brought you connections or anything else related to your work?
Well, I certainly have a lot of impressive friends, yourself included, and it's kind of like I have the last laugh with the art world, because I didn't hit the right notes with the art scene. I had a few exhibits, one at the ICA, and I don't play the art game very well, and I'm not, you know, fabulous, and, you know, of course everyone wanted to be Warhol and be fabulous and shoot, you know, the nightlife, but so I always thought, gee, you know, it's probably not going to happen, you know, but now someone will see 3,000 people of my Facebook friends will see my work, and that's probably more traffic than any gallery in Newbury Street will see in, you know, 4 months. So it's quite exciting to be alive, just to be able to, you know, put something that the size of your thumbnail that holds 3,000 pictures, just to put it out for the world to see. It's, you know, and you know, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. I try to not put everything out there, and I do. You know, I am reserved, and I don't, you know, and I don't want to do other, I'm not interested in going on other social media right now, because I just don't want to dilute what I do. I guess I'm a Facebook brand right now. But if Google
Plus
wants to offer me a contract. But anyway, so, yeah.
And so, it's exciting talking to you. I think to hear, you know, how your career arcs is really interesting. I'm going to put a few websites that you've mentioned also attached to this interview. For artists listening to you, you know, they're seeing your career, which is kind of amazing, the way you're so bold in moving into places and meeting people and getting involved in different scenes and ultimately being, you know, as you've said, the most famous unknown photographer, right? Is that how you phrased it?
In Boston, yeah. Boston.
In Boston. And, you know, I guess that's how I perceive you to some extent. And
mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you want to say to artists that are listening, also thinking that they're photographers and they're also wondering how they're going to generate or develop their careers?
Well, don't sell out. Enjoy what you're doing. Try to keep the passion there. Don't, if you're a student, don't treat it like you have to take piano lessons. just think that, you know, when you go on a bus, you're going to someplace you've never been before. It's all new. You can just grab a bus out of your wherever you live and go somewhere. Every day there's something new out there. So it's just, you know, is. And then also, if you plan a trip, actually I'm going to Detroit tomorrow on one of my city trips. You know, if things don't work out, like you miss a plane or you miss something, make that part of the experience. Photograph it and just look at the humor side of it. And if it's raining out, pictures are different. There's people with colorful umbrellas. And just make it all part of the journey, you know. Just enjoy it and just keep at it.
Sid, thanks so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate the time you've taken to do this.
Okay. Take care. Thanks, Brandon.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.